You're listening to Stealing from Wizards, Volume 3, Kidnapping, by R.A. Consul.
Chapter 9, New Camelot. A letter finally arrived explaining that Kuro's fears were completely unfounded. Of course he would be allowed to go. Of course they'd confirmed it with the summer court. There were no concerns whatsoever. He couldn't be blamed for the crimes of his creators. That would have been more comforting if it hadn't taken until the day before departure to arrive. Nothing could reasonably explain the weeks it took to get that response if it had actually been as easy as claimed. Hidden between the comforting assurances was an unwritten story about last-minute negotiations between the guard, who aimed at keeping up the facade that Kuro was just like any other student, and the summer court, who had no interest or incentive to do so. Kuro wondered what manner of threats and promises Dubois had offered in exchange for his safe passage. Also, whether the trip would turn into an impromptu trial. Arthur did not appear to wonder at all and saw nothing suspicious about the letter from his father. It confirmed what Arthur already believed about Kuro, that he was harmless and innocent. The final line of the letter showed that he was the only one who felt that way. Try to keep Kuro out of trouble. That was a rude request to make of Arthur. It wasn't like trouble was something Kuro clumsily stumbled into that a guiding hand from a responsible companion could prevent. Trouble sought him out, hunted him, and aimed to consume him whole. Keeping him out of trouble was like asking Arthur to fight off a tiger that already had Kuro halfway down its throat. When he expressed that opinion out loud to his friends on the ferry ride across the bay, they refused the idea as paranoid nonsense. Whether it was out of compassionate generosity, naivete, or a chronic inability to recognize simple patterns, Kuro couldn't guess, but it was awfully kind of them to say it. They maintained their position, even as he and his bag were searched twice as long as anyone else, and wavered only slightly when they discovered Autolycus stowed away in the undercarriage of the bus. Wondering how he got there would have undermined their position, and so they just celebrated his company, which was broadly preferred to Kuro's anyway. The raccoon was curious, friendly, and often mistaken for adorable, while his more human creator was frequently sullen and, as they had quite rightly accused, paranoid. The terrible problem with his paranoia was that it was correct just often enough to make it hard to shake free of. He had ultimately been wrong about being forbidden to go on the trip. Despite his misgivings about when and how that permission had been granted, it was still a mark against his constant anxieties. A worry that the trip was a way to lure the children en masse into the relatively unguarded wilderness between the school and New Camelot also turned out to be unwarranted. The convoy of limousines and grand carriages passed without a challenge along the ferry road, as did the yellow school bus that followed them carrying the autumn lodgers. The light snows of early winter near the bay melted away, and bare trees filled with red and yellow leaves, as if their journey south were rewinding the clock days by the mile. His fear that he would be pulled from the bus by knights the moment they crossed into New Camelot and forced into a pillory in the town square to be stoned by the populace was also rebuffed. They passed through the high stone walls of the fortress city, slowing only to navigate the narrow streets. Even so, he couldn't help but plan escape routes. The lower city was a paradise for undersized criminals on the run. Whoever decided on the area contained by the outer wall had made it a bit too small, and so the buildings were precariously tall and narrow, all crammed too tightly together. Much like the people of New Camelot, however, they were too polite to touch each other, creating a maze of alleys shrouded in perpetual darkness, too narrow for an adult to navigate at any speed. His intent, should they attempt to capture him, was to leap from the bus window, then lose himself in the alleys until he could find a path to the Blandlands. He'd leave his bag and Autolycus in the care of Charlie and disappear from the fairy realm forever. As chance would have it, he did not need that plan. Though Charlie expressed some delight that she'd be trusted with such precious things should Kuro be forced to flee. As they passed through the inner walls to the Royal Mile, his worries began to slacken. they had allowed him passage into the lands of the nobility unchallenged. The upper city housed sprawling gardens and palatial manors, kept safe behind tall and pointed iron fences. Perhaps they were meant to keep out intruders, but they also kept any of that vibrant color from escaping to the lower city and risking a commoner interacting with something green. The student convoy rolled up to the gates of the royal grounds without the merest hint of trouble. It was difficult to choose whether to call the building there a palace, a castle, or a fortress. The structure was both impenetrable and ornate, with intricate mosaics and delicate stained glass windows decorating stone walls thick enough to survive a meteor strike. Meticulously regimented gardens and inlaid brick walkways welcomed visitors to a towering entryway, while the crenellated parapets and arrow slits in the tower overlooking the entrance threatened certain death to anyone foolish enough to approach. It was like a battle axe with a bouquet. The Autumn Lodge bus waited at the end of the line of vehicles for the others to unload their passengers. Each new group was met by a gaggle of stray servants who carted their luggage and escorted them into the palace grounds, where they could be greeted by each of the seven Knights of the Sun in full formal uniform, sword and all. At last it was the lodger's turn. Their group was larger than the others, as the entire residence was in a single vehicle, and there was something of a standoff with the porters as they disembarked. The students were so used to being ignored by the servants of the other residences on Avalon that they started grabbing their own suitcases and backpacks, while the palace staff tried to do it for them. The fine manners of the royal attendants meant that they could not directly tell the students to put down their stuff and leave it to the professionals, so they instead engaged in a battle of competitive politeness. "Could I be of assistance, ma'am?" "I've got it, no problem." "Just let me know if there's anything I can do for you, sir." "I'm good, thanks though." "Is there anything I can do to lighten your burden, honored guest?" "Nah, it's not heavy. I love your jacket. Can I try it on? What's your name?" "I'm Charlotte Cook, but everyone calls me Charlie. Have you worked here long? Were you around for the coup?" "I guess not, since you look pretty young." "That's probably for the best anyway. It sounds like it was pretty bad, but you can't even tell anymore. I guess they've had a long time to fix the holes and all."
Since Kuro had no luggage beyond his satchel, he avoided negotiations with the staff and ambled onto palace grounds to admire the rose beds and topiary. Of course, his internal alarms were screaming that something terrible would happen the moment he passed the palace gates, but those were the same alarms that had been sounding since the trip had been announced. They were the background noise of his life. This time, though, they were accompanied by alarms everyone could hear. As he stepped over the threshold, sirens blared into life. Chains erupted from the ground and coiled around him, yanking his arms apart, encasing his hands in steel, and gagging him. The knights in the courtyard sprang into action, reaching for their swords as their stately gray uniforms began to shimmer and transform. He saw little else, as his view was rapidly obscured by a thick fog which swirled around him and condensed into a dome of ice. He could hear raised voices through the thick, frozen walls of his cage, but it was far too muffled to make out the words. Out of sight, he considered whether he could slip his bonds. He tested them gently, to which they reacted by tightening further. He knew the type. They would crush him should he struggle, though they should loosen again if he stayed still, and would relax entirely if he died. He'd discovered that flaw in their design the other time he ran afoul of a similar trap. Following orders from Phineas to perish should he be captured, he had escaped the chains by having his heart stop briefly. Very nearly dying, though, wasn't an ideal means of escape, as it relied on a rather time-consuming recovery process if it worked, and carried a significant chance that it would not. He decided to wait and see how things played out. It didn't take long before the tip of a sword slid through the ice wall surrounding him. It stayed still, pointing at Kuro's head for a few moments, then began to hum. The whole prison of ice began to sing along with it, like a crystal goblet with a finger running around its rim, but at a deafening volume. Then, all at once, the ice shattered into hailstones, which collapsed on and around him. Half buried in the remains of the cage and still bound by chains, Kuro faced the wielder of the sword, a knight, resplendent in their armor. It had a bright mirror finish from head to toe, ready to reflect blade and spell alike, and leaving no gap, not even slits for eyes in the visor. Two pairs of wings folded flat against the knight's back, articulated joints, and an hourglass silhouette
gave them the look of a chrome-plated mantis. They raised their sword and brought it down in an elegant flourish, cleaving the chains like butter. As the remnants of the restraints fell from Kuro, the knight's armor also melted away, revealing the gentle but refined features of Arthur's mother. No longer being held in chains at swordpoint, Kuro quickly scanned for other threats. It looked as though a hurricane had passed through. Apparently upset at their separation, the wind had worked herself into a frenzy. Flower beds were torn up and strewn with luggage. Servants and students alike picked through the debris, attempting to match socks to suitcases. Behind the gates, an elder knight, clad in armor so black he appeared like a hole in the world, had removed his helmet for the express purpose of berating a junior.
"McCool, you are meant to watch for him. How'd he slip by you? He's not exactly invisible, is he?"
The younger knight slumped under the accusations and let his gleaming copper armor melt away, revealing a matching mop of hair and a splatter of freckles. He failed to defend himself and instead stared sullenly at the ground in front of him. Kuro felt a good measure of responsibility for the dressing down the young knight was receiving. He had slipped through the horde of students dismounting the bus, sticking in blind spots and dodging people's gazes. It was more out of habit than anything, and his attention had just been avoiding making a fuss. He wasn't trying to sneak in. Farther on into the courtyard, schoolmates scowled at him for causing a ruckus and for messing up their carefully styled hair and wardrobe. None voiced their complaints yet, however, as none were brave enough to interrupt the knight facing him. The two people he thought most likely to join the lady in her interrogation of Kuro weren't even paying attention. Azalea and Moira were engaged in some kind of whispered argument that had the former flushed with some combination of shame and anger, and the latter wearing a look of smug satisfaction. "Are you okay?" Lady Omwirius asked while sheathing her sword, bringing his attention back to her. Kuro had learned that people preferred he report even minor injuries when asked in that manner, so he did a quick inventory. "Fine," he confirmed. "Nothing broken, maybe a couple bruises."
"I'm glad to hear it." Lady Omwirius sighed with a weary sort of relief. "'Twas your bracelet, if you're curious. Talyn informed us that it might trigger our security wards. Young Sir McCool over there was supposed to escort you through. Perhaps you could rejoin your fellow lodgers while I rescue him from Sir Bor's wrath." Her tone was jovial, but her eyes betrayed a level of dismay as she surveyed the scene. "Please avoid crossing the gates unaccompanied, if you would be so kind."
Kuro skulked over to the other lodgers from his year, who had gathered a safe distance from the shouting knight and the epicenter of his formal welcome to New Camelot. Jennifer greeted him with a gentle ribbing.
"We really can't take you anywhere, can we?"
"I, for one, appreciate his efforts," added Gregory. "What are the chances we'd see the knights in full armor otherwise? The whole trip would probably be dull as muck without him around."
Kuro looked to his friends for rescue, but Charlie's method of helping was to fill all the possible space herself.
"That was so cool!"
she announced loudly enough to have knights reaching again for their swords.
"Those changes burst out of nowhere! And then Azalea made that ice wall so fast! I thought it was part of the trap! And that takes some real control to do, because if she got it wrong, she could have turned you into an ice cube. But she didn't, so that's fine. Not that she'd hurt you on purpose, obviously, but people can make mistakes. But gosh, that takes some real skill. Where do you think she practices that?"
Kuro had assumed the ice had been part of the security system. The fact that it had been Azalea surprised him only in that she had elected not to freeze him solid, given the opportunity. Perhaps she was no longer keen to murder him in public. Charlie's praise of Azalea's incredible ability to imprison Kuro was interrupted by some attendants attempting to lead them into the palace. Their arrival failed to catch her attention, and their gentle clearing of their throats did no better. Marie was able to redirect the steady flow of words, however, by gripping her roommate on the shoulders and turning her to face the team of palace staff.
"Oh, hi, I love your jackets. Are they as warm as they look?"
Fortunately, their classmates were too eager to be shown to the rooms to allow her to cause too much delay. One servant sacrificed herself to answering Charlie's questions, while the others directed the group of autumn lodgers inside. The fortress-like exterior of the palace in no way reflected what was inside. The yard-thick walls of enchanted stone might not have even been made to defend the palace. They were necessary to hold up the sheer weight of things hanging from them. Every surface was covered. Paintings, tapestries, trophies, and shields cluttered the walls so much that many overlapped with each other. What didn't fit on the walls spilled out onto the floor. Statues and suits of armor fought for space with vases, taxidermy, and display cases, which were in turn stuffed to bursting with trinkets. If the displays had ever had an organizing principle, it had long ago been abandoned in favor of fitting more things in, jigsaw-like. It reminded Kuro of some homes he'd visited of recluse wizards, who couldn't bear to part with anything, and so their dwellings were packed floor to ceiling with barely space to move. Here, rather than old newspapers and bottle caps, there were priceless artifacts and masterpieces. The decor was all the more strange as it was necessarily done by choice. It wasn't like the kings and queens of Tirnanog lacked the resources to expand the palace. They didn't even need to build bigger walls. They could have just made the inside bigger, as in Kuro's bag. Even Avalon Junior High was larger on the inside than out. As they followed, single file, through the halls, Kuro started to think it might be part of the castle's defenses. The sheer quantity of things was so overwhelming it was hard to navigate the entirely straight hallways. He didn't spend much time thinking about that, though. The crowded halls required constant attention on the west wind. As the moment Kuro's focus shifted, she became agitated and started whirling up and down the hallway. It seemed like the combination of bracelet and clutter confused her, and she couldn't tell where Kuro was if he stopped thinking of her. The avalanche of decor ended abruptly at a pair of heavy double doors. They were thick and solid, clad with iron fittings, and swung reluctantly on their hinges. The hall beyond was well appointed with tapestries and banners, but seemed almost naked in comparison with the rest of the palace. It was possible to move through the corridor three abreast without fear of knocking over some precious vase.
"Pair up and pick a room."
The instruction came from behind the gaggle of lodgers. They turned to find the copper knight slouching against the doorframe. He was no longer in his armor, but his sword still hung at his belt, and he fidgeted with the hilt absently.
"Here?" asked Grigory. "Isn't this the knight's hall?"
"Aye," confirmed the young knight. "Is that a problem?"
Grigory was at a loss as to how to respond. He sputtered a bit before Meredith took over.
"Won't the knights mind?"
The young man shrugged.
"There's well enough rooms for 50 knights and their squires. All but a few are gathering dust like most of this place. If the door's locked, leave it be. Otherwise, make yourself at home."
There was a moment's pause while the assembled students waited for him to confess some sort of joke. When it became clear that no such admission was forthcoming, the corridor erupted into life. Heated negotiations about who would be rooming with whom were punctuated by rapid opening and slamming of doors as everyone hunted for the best rooms, and subsequently drowned out by arguments over claims. Kuro was spared the war of social maneuvering. Sir McCool summoned him with a subtle tip of his head. Speaking low enough that others wouldn't hear over the din of battle for lodgings, he said,
"You take that room over there across the mine. Don't leave this hallway without me, and don't so much as walk through the doorway without my say-so, unless you want to repeat of that miss at the gate."
He said it with all the vigor of a reluctant babysitter dictating bedtimes he had no desire to enforce.
"How did you get stuck watching me?" asked Kuro as he moved to inspect his assigned chamber.
It was far more elegant than the unadorned wooden door implied. It had three beds in decreasing size, as if three bears lived there. It also housed a desk, a dressing table, and an armoire, and included a private bathroom. The walls were covered in a colorful mural of intertwining vines and flowers.
"I made the terrible mistake of being the youngest," replied McCool. "Also, the one with the least interest in you."
Kuro raised an eyebrow, curious about the claimed disinterest.
"The older knights have been arguing a lot about you. They think you could be a spy or an assassin or something. Phineas Arryn turned some of the most trusted staff in the castle against us back during the coup. Bors lost an arm to one and is still looking for vengeance. They also think you might know something about the missing heir and want to interrogate you. A couple are convinced that you're a damsel in distress and need a rescue."
It wasn't clear how letting him attend a school field trip would be considered rescue, but Kuro didn't feel it worth questioning.
"Not you?"
he asked. Sir McCool, leaning against the doorframe, shook his head slightly and provided a dismissive shrug.
"You're just some kid. No worse than any other of these hooligans." He gestured to the bedlam in the hallway. "But they want you watched, so I'll watch. I'll do my best not to ruin your trip. Do us both a favor and keep in sight and out of trouble."
He did want to promise both of those things, but Kuro had no confidence in his ability to fulfill the request, regardless of his intentions. "I'll do my best," was all he could offer before their conversation was interrupted.
"I thought you found another roommate."
Arthur's voice was level, but his face was full of panic, shifting between the features of other lodgers at random.
"You haven't, have you?"
McCool moved aside to allow him to escape the disorganization and noise of the hallway. Once his nerves had settled enough to notice the surroundings, he asked, "Why does your room look different than the others?" Having only seen this chamber, Kuro couldn't answer. McCool, though, could.
"The others aren't claimed," he said. "This one still has a squire who could take it on if there's ever anyone to knight her. These are the Lamorak chambers."
Thank you for listening to Stealing from Wizards. If you liked our show, please consider rating or reviewing on iTunes. If you want to support this podcast or just can't wait for the next chapter, the full book is available on Amazon, Kobo, and Indigo. Our theme music was written by Camille Saint-Saëns, transcribed by Franz Liszt, performed by Rebecca Verdun, and used with permission. This episode was produced by Jim Tigwell.